From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Regarding Super Bowl XLIII, of cardinal significance is the presence of the Cardinals, who hope to steal the title from the favored Steelers. Ahead on Only a Game, a report from Arizona where disbelief still reigns. Also, a conversation with L. John Wertheim about the rise of mixed martial arts. Also ahead, with the help of the coach's unorthodox philosophy, Trinity College men's squash goes for 11 straight NCAA titles.
We try to live with the awesome power of now. Live that match, that practice, as if it were the last one of their lives. If you can get 22 kids doing that, you create a maelstrom of energy that is almost, you almost can't beat that.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The words I'm about to read are not a misprint. The Arizona Cardinals are going to the Super Bowl. The Arizona Cardinals, who up until this year had won a grand total of one playoff game since they moved to Arizona from St. Louis 20 years ago. If you think I'm skeptical about their chances a week from tomorrow, you should hear what their fans, players, and even their head coach say about them. From Phoenix, Mark Moran of KJZZ has our report.
Docking inside the 10. That's it. The Cardinals have shocked the world. Trite but true. The Cards have done it. They're going to Super Bowl 43.
Until last Sunday, the Cardinals hadn't won any kind of championship since 1947, when the Chicago Cardinals played in wool uniforms with leather helmets and no face masks on Soldier Field. Now, Arizonans, including Mesa resident and Cardinals season ticket holder Brian Shackelford, hardly know what to think when he hears the national media pundits talking about the Arizona Cardinals.
And whether they're saying that they're going to lose this week or they shouldn't have won last week, just the simple fact that they're saying the Cardinals' name over the airways on the national media is such a shock. To have the announcer say that the Pittsburgh Steelers have earned the right to play the Arizona Cardinals in the Super Bowl.
Sure, the Cards won their division and made the playoffs, but only after limping into the end of the season by losing four of their last six games. NBC's Chris Collinsworth called this the worst playoff team in history, and almost everybody seemed to agree with him. After Arizona's first-round victory over the Falcons, coach Ken Wisenhunt made a full lap around Cardinal Stadium, thanking fans because even he wasn't sure they'd be back to play again at home. But now that they're in the Super Bowl, the bandwagon is wobbling under the sheer weight. Jerry Lugo, clad in an old Cards t-shirt, says he's been watching the same old sorry Cardinals since he was a little boy. And when they beat the Eagles to finally get to the Super Bowl,
half my family was crying, and I even wanted to share a tear or two, but we were suffering for a long time. Yeah, we had some family members that passed away, diehard fans, and we finally did it for them too.
Okay, so there may be some true diehards who really did believe from the beginning. But if you listen carefully to the post-NFC championship words of 37-year-old graybeard quarterback Kurt Warner, you can almost hear his disbelief.
When everybody counted us out, when everybody counted me out, when everybody told us every single week, well, okay, Cardinals don't have a chance against Atlanta. They definitely don't have a chance against Carolina, and they really don't have a chance against Philadelphia. And then to accomplish that, I think, is really, really special.
With a week to go before the Super Bowl, there's still plenty of time for every possible storyline. And here's an interesting twist. Kurt Warner came to Arizona because nobody else would give him a chance. And coach Ken Wisenhunt came here because he was passed over for the head coaching job in, of all places, Pittsburgh, which, ironically, the Cards will face in the Super Bowl.
Did you expect anything different? When we actually won the game, how could it not have been the Steelers? That was what I expected. So, it's just a shame that there won't be many storylines this week because of these two matchups.
One part of the storyline has not changed throughout the postseason. The Cardinals are underdogs in Tampa. Pittsburgh is favored to win Super Bowl 43 by a touchdown. But that's not dimming the enthusiasm of Cardinals fan Jerry Lugo.
They're going to take the championship. They got to win the Super Bowl because we've been waiting for too long.
Well, Cardinals fans will believe that when they see it. For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
While some Arizonans head to the store for the addition of some extra red, yellow, and white in their wardrobes before the big day, Tom Santucci is already all set. He owns enough black and gold to dress not only himself, but also to adorn his wife, his daughters, and his entire house and yard. Tom Santucci lives in what has become known as the Steelers House in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, and he joins me now on the line from that house. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I've seen the video of your home on YouTube, but for those among our listeners who have not seen that video, can you briefly describe it for me?
Well, it's hard to describe, I guess, unless you've actually seen it, but the house is black and gold, bricks, tons of flags and posters and inflatable Stiller guys, and steps are painted black and gold.
Of course.
I have a terrible truck outside. I used to have a terrible Lincoln that was painted black and gold, but now I had to get rid of that, so now I have a terrible truck.
Well, it's one thing to put up banners and paint your truck in Steelers colors and even to put signs on your lawn and inflatable Steeler figures, but when it came time to paint your front steps black and gold and to actually paint the bricks in your house black and gold, did you worry at all about the resale value?
Well, my house is more or less a historic landmark now, so actually I would think I would raise the value of the house.
An excellent point. I assume your neighbors, if they're not Steelers fans, they're certainly not telling you that they're not Steelers fans.
No, I think they're Steelers fans. I'm sure they wouldn't put up with it if they weren't. But occasionally I have people from Cleveland or maybe Baltimore driving by, and, well, I can't say what they yell, but some of them throw stuff. But for the most part, it's a pretty good experience. And my wife is just as big a fan as I am, so it's a happy household as far as that goes.
Now, will you be watching the Super Bowl from the Steelers' house, or are you going to be in Tampa?
No. Unfortunately, I'll be at the Steeler house, which is fine because it's kind of crazy here on Super Bowl Sunday, so with all the people driving by and taking pictures and honking their horns, and it's a lot of fun.
And it'll be more fun, of course, if, the odds are correct and the Steelers win this thing.
Well, you said if. I have no doubt in my mind that the Steelers are going to win, but it might be a close game.
Tom Santucci is the proud owner of the Steelers House outside of Pittsburgh. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Go Steelers.
You never know just how good you got it.
The Sunday before the Super Bowl is typically devoid of football, but that will change next year with the NFL's new plan to fill that void with the Pro Bowl, the league's version of the All-Star Game. Only a Game's Doug Tribou bids adieu to the NFL's last football-free fortnight.
Since the Super Bowl began in 1967, only a handful of games have been played on the Sunday immediately following the NFC and AFC championship games. Most notably, the 2002 Super Bowl, when the NFL adjusted its schedule because of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Paul Attner covered 30 Super Bowls during his 40-year career as a reporter for the Washington Post and the Sporting News.
The two-week gap gives the NFL an opportunity to have the game hyped to such a level where no matter what the matchup is, it seems competitive. Every time they went to 1 week, if they got a bad mismatch, I don't think the game was nearly as anticipated as is once the two-week period.
That period is filled with the media's player profiles, team profiles, coach profiles, city profiles, stadium profiles, fan profiles, and profiles of the profilers. Jack Hacksaw Reynolds played on two Super Bowl championship teams for the San Francisco 49ers in the 1980s, and Attner says Reynolds was prepared for the two-week gap before Super Bowl 19.
Hacksaw Reynolds was so tired of being asked, how did you get the nickname Hacksaw, that he actually handed out sheets of paper explaining how his nickname was created.
In case you're wondering, Reynolds used a hacksaw to cut a car in half after his college football team suffered an embarrassing loss. Dave Goldberg is a professional football writer for the Associated Press and has covered 25 Super Bowls. He says having 2 weeks off often means that a non-football story becomes the biggest story, as was the case when Jim McMahon and the Chicago Bears were practicing a few days before Super Bowl XX in 1986.
A helicopter flew over and he mooned it, and of course word got out. So that became the story. And the whole story that week was McMahon. They were playing New England, which was kind of an afterthought, and then the game proved that it was 46-10.
Goldberg says the media circus surrounding the games can create some strange situations.
The reporters are celebrities. I mean, I once saw Chris Berman signing autographs for players.
The NFL recently announced next year the traditional Open Sunday will be filled by the Pro Bowl. The league's All-Star game has been played in Hawaii the week after the Super Bowl since 1980, but in 2010 it will be played the week before in Miami, the same city hosting the Super Bowl. Goldberg says the move is more about pumping up the Pro Bowl than filling up the time off.
The NFL may be the number one league, but its All-Star game has always been the last, including probably the hockey, too. A lot is made of the selection of the Pro Bowl, but not very much of the game.
The new schedule will mean players from the two Super Bowl teams who are selected to play in the Pro Bowl will not be able to participate in the All-Star game. The NFL says it will re-examine the date and location of the Pro Bowl after next year's experiment. Peter King is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He says the 2 weeks off before the Super Bowl are a way for the NFL to generate more media hype. But with or without the Pro Bowl to fill the football void, the time off also serves a practical purpose.
There are some people who are going to go to the big game anyway, but I think there are also a group of maybe about 30,000 loyalists of their teams in the game who are going to go there. And so for them to be able to make plans 6 days out is a little bit more difficult.
And for this year at least, that means fans looking for some football have to hold out for one more week. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
Fans of Buffalo, New York, Miami, New England, Indianapolis. Hey, folks in Denver, Kansas City, San Diego, Oakland, Seattle. Hey, round and round, swing it.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Around the world, across the nation, everybody's Super Bowl twist. Come join us in the celebration, bring a friend, you're on the party list.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. As the new year began, Kazumi Izaki of Yokohama, Japan, decided that she had to have what she called a major target. And so the former aerobics instructor will shoot for a world title, more precisely the Super Flyweight Women's World Championship. Though she acknowledges that she was initially horrified at having to punch somebody when she began learning to box 8 years ago, Ms. Izaki now trains each night after preparing dinner for her family. Should she prevail in her February 28th bout against Mexico's Ana Maria Torres, Kazumi Izaki will become the first boxer since George Foreman to win a world title at the age of 45.
Oh, super fly. You're gonna make your fortune by and by. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at the rise of mixed martial arts with Sports Illustrated's L. John Wertheim. But first, the NHL is in the midst of its annual All-Star Weekend, and so here to talk some good hockey at the break is Helene Elliott of the L.A. Times. Hi, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Of the 42 players selected for the 2009 All-Star Team East and West, were there any surprises or perhaps glaring omissions?
I think there were a lot of glaring omissions from the original fan balloting. But you know what? Over the years, I've come to think that if that's who fans want in the game, if that's the way the league set it up, that's who fans should be able to see. You know, you get people saying, oh, the All-Star team is a travesty, and it's a popularity contest, and it's, you know, people can stuff the ballot box and all that. If they want to vote for those folks, it's absolutely fine with me. All-Star games in just about every sport have just become corporate parties. I don't think they mean as much to the athletes themselves as they used to. And you know what? Fans get the short end of the stick so much in every sport in all over the world now. This is their one chance to say who they want to see. Let them see those players.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the party aspect and the entertainment aspect of All-Star Weekend, because there will be events such as the hardest shot competition, the most accurate shot competition, the fastest skater, the elimination shootout, and something called the breakaway challenge. Are any of these as entertaining as a slam dunk contest?
Well, they were all designed in response to the slam dunk contest, although if you ask Commissioner Bettman, of course, he will recoil in horror if you say those three little letters NBA. He likes to pretend the NBA doesn't exist. But you know what? It's fun. There's no harm in an All-Star weekend, and the harder shot stuff is fun. You know, the people in the building really get to enjoy it. And I was talking to John Sebastian Jaguar of the Ducks, who will be the starting West goalie, and he was saying, I have a big family. I can't get enough tickets for everybody to come to the game, but I can get some people to the festivities on Saturday, and I can get other people into the skills contest. So it's a good thing for the players. I know when I've covered it, I really haven't done a whole lot with the fastest skater type thing, because it's just kind of bogus. But it's fun for everybody. And you know what? We're so serious, and we take all this so seriously. Having fun, that's a good idea sometimes.
It seems to me there's been more fighting in NHL games this season than in the past few seasons, at least. Am I right about that?
I think if you look around, yeah. The fighting has always been such a contentious issue, and it always will be. If you have the, I don't know if pleasure is the word, the opportunity to watch Don Cherry on Coach's Corner on the Hockey Night in Canada every Saturday, you know, he recoils in horror and as if he'd been shot when people suggest taking fighting out of the game. And I can understand the point of view that fighting is part of the game. I think it turns off a lot of people, though, and always will. But if that's what hockey wants to be, you know, there are general managers who love that stuff, and Brian Burke of the Toronto Maple Leafs would certainly be one of them. And I was reading a story the other day in the Hockey News, or somebody took a survey and asked some of the general managers if fighting should be removed for the game, and they all said no, only a couple of dissenters. It is part of the game. You don't want it to be the kind of bench-clearing brawls like you used to have in the 70s with the Flyers, but, you know, the stakes are higher, too. You know, the salaries are higher. Players want to keep going in the playoffs. So everything is just intensified, and that's where I think you see more fighting.
This year's All-Star Game will be played in Montreal, where the Canadiens have been playing for 100 seasons. What sort of events, aside from the All-Star Game itself, are planned to celebrate the milestone?
Well, they've actually been celebrating all season, and it's a great thing. I mean, the Canadians know how to throw a ceremony. They know how to stage a ceremony and throw a party. I mean, they've had a little practice with that Stanley Cup thing, you know, that they're carrying it around and all, although not lately, but all season it's been great. They've honored different players, and they keep so many of their alumni involved, and that's a wonderful thing, too. You know, you see these folks who played in the 50s and 60s, and they bring them back, and they're just wonderful ambassadors, like Jean Beliveau, and it's just wonderful to see them.
When regular season play resumes on Tuesday, the Rangers, the Capitals, the Red Wings, the Flames, the Sharks, and, of course, the Bruins will be leading their respective divisions. Do you expect those current standings to endure?
You know, I had to say that I was a little skeptical about the Bruins at first, but I think they've proved themselves, and I think that's terrific. And I hereby nominate them to host the next Winter Classic outdoor game. Wouldn't that be cool in Fenway Park?
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, Bruins and Red Sox, get on the stick, would you?
Well, if there's enough money in it for the Red Sox owners, they'll probably go along.
Yes, money makes the world go round, doesn't it?
San Jose has lost only 6 of their 45 games this season. Do the Sharks reflect a certain Stanley Cup shine this year?
I think that they might go to the conference final and lose, or go to the cup final and lose before they actually win it. And if you look back at in recent years, you'll see that a lot of teams made the final and or conference final and had to learn, you know, what it takes to get that far before they actually won the cup. I mean, you look at the Ducks in 2003, they lost in the Stanley Cup finals, and then in 2006, they lost in the conference final before they made it to the Stanley Cup finals and won the cup. You have to go through it to know what it takes. I like a lot of the things the Sharks are doing. Their coach, Todd McClellan, used to be a coach with the Red Wings, an assistant with the Red Wings. They respect him. They like him. You know, he's in his first season. He's done some great things. He's gotten their defensemen more involved in the play. And when you have mobile defensemen and guys who have good shots from the point, let her rip. I like that team. I've been hesitant to pick them in the past few seasons, but I just might have to pick them this season.
What about dark horses? Find a team for me likely to get a second wind after the All-Star break and maybe even disrupt that much-to-be-desired Bruins-Sharks-Stanley Cup final matchup.
I would kind of look at a couple of teams, maybe the Calgary Flames. The guy who's normally been their top defenseman, Dion Phaneuf, has not had a great season. I would look for him to turn it up a little bit. I like Calgary's depth. I like their toughness. I just like everything about them. I would not be surprised to see them have a really good post-All-Star spurt here. In the East, I'm curious to see if the Capitals keep going and pick it up a little bit more. I mean, Ovechkin can carry that team, and he probably will.
Helene Elliott covers the National Hockey League for the LA Times, and she's our hockey all-star here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
Boxers can't wrestle each other to the canvas or kick each other. Wrestlers can't slug each other in the jaw, but practitioners of mixed martial arts can do these things, and they can box and wrestle as well. In Blood in the Cage, subtitled Mixed Martial Arts, Pat Miletich and the Furious Rise of the UFC, Eljon Wertheim has written about mixed martial arts, and in particular the sport's most visible manifestation, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Eljon Wertheim joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Mixed martial arts was first marketed as single combat with no rules, and the promoters regarded charges of barbarity as, quote, good publicity. Were those promoters right?
They were right for what they were offering at the time. This sport has really undergone pretty rapid transformation. It began when it first debuted here in the U.S. in the mid-90s. It was just awful. I mean, just indefensible, barbaric is accurate, this cultural rot where you had guys pulling out hair and put in these cages and just doing horrible things. And in a very fast period of time, thanks to political pressure and legislation and I think common sense, it's evolved into something much different. And it's not ballet they're doing right now, but it has certainly, it's a bit more palatable.
And it's interesting that you say it's not ballet that they're doing right now, because at one point while you were watching a match, you wrote in your notebook, ballet.
Yeah, there was this real level of athleticism, and I think people are surprised when they hear me say that. But these are trained athletes who really practice a sport. They're not just going in there and brawling. They don't have the emotion of a fight. They're not angry. They've practiced. They've rehearsed. They know the tactics. There's a subtlety to it, and it is legitimate. It's elite-level wrestling. It's elite-level martial arts and elite-level boxing. And in that case, it was a fighter, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu artist named Anderson Silva. And I scribbled in my note ballet, because what he was doing just seemed nothing like fighting. It really was almost balletic.
I have to admire your courage, because when you first began researching this book, one of your potential subjects offered to break your nose. Why was that?
They couldn't wrap their brain around the fact that I was going to try and, I didn't approach this as advocacy. It was more just sort of a curiosity and what is this culture all about? And to some of these fighters, they just couldn't grasp that I hadn't been in a fight as an adult. How was I going to write about this and have a sense of what they went through when I had never had my nose broken? So without any menace, I mean, it was more sort of for my own edification, I was given a generous offer. They would break my nose and reset it. And I just couldn't bring myself to let that happen. To their great disappointment, I tried to explain that, you know, one can decide they've had a good meal or a bad meal without being a chef, and like a movie without ever having been a director. What I did happen, though, I did let a fighter kick me in the hip at about three-quarter speed. This is the kind of kick that doesn't even go remarked upon when it occurs in a fight. And yet when this was done to me, I had a welt on my hip and you know, walked funny the next day. So my appreciation for their pain threshold, if nothing else, went up after that.
If the sport of mixed martial arts can be said to have a single hero, at least historically, perhaps it is Pat Miletich. How important has his career in the octagon and outside of it been to the development of the sport?
Yeah, he was the figure who I sort of chose to base this book on and personalize this culture through his story. And it really mirroring the sport itself. This guy was this back alley brawler and would get in fights, and he once cracked a toilet seat with another guy's head. And he discovered these martial arts. He discovered sort of the calm and the ethic that goes with it, and gradually, you know, became a legitimate fighter. The same way UFC started as this barbaric back alley, you know, just freak show, and gradually has sort of at least come close to the mainstream. And now Pat Miletich, you know, he's a former UFC champion, and now he trains the next generation of fighters. And his training gym is really, it's about the maneuvers and about the subtleties of this brand of fighting. But there also is this sort of ethical component. He also sort of really preaches the philosophy of this. And you're not going in there to hurt someone, and your opponent is not your enemy. And I think he's done a lot. It was really fascinating spending time around him.
You write that Miletich would have been a great soldier, although he never enlisted, and also that patriotism is a powerful component of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. What exactly do you mean by patriotism in that context?
First of all, there's a very sort of, I think the fighters by and large tend to the political right. A lot of them were in the military, in fact. There's a lot of military components to how they train, but there's this real libertarian thread that runs through the sport. And when it comes under fire, one of the fallbacks is, you know, we live in a free country, and if I'm willing to assume the risk, then by gosh, I should be allowed to compete. And there, you go to these fights and you talk to these fighters, and at least in my, you know, I'm a sports writer and I live in Manhattan, so maybe this isn't I'm not getting the best cross section here, but I was taken by how generally patriotic these fighters were top to bottom.
You write that it helped mixed martial arts that I'm quoting now, after the September 11th attacks and the start of the war in Iraq, attitudes toward tough, aggressive American men generally improved. I don't know how that could be established exactly, but what happened to those attitudes when enthusiasm for the war in Iraq began to evaporate?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, the sport had sort of grown into something different by then. But I in researching this book, one thing I heard from the fighters all the time was everybody gets a trophy now in society, and you can't ride a bike without wearing knee pads and a helmet, and you can't go on a diving board anymore because you might get hurt. And this was sort of backlash from this protectionist culture out there.
In the chapter titled The Final Round, you describe what seems to be a definitive moment in a bout between L.C. Davis and Rafael Diaz. Would you read the passage that describes how that fight ended?
Can you promise me my mother's not listening?
I promise nothing of the kind. We're on 185 stations across the country.
Then it came, a maneuver that encapsulated everything exhilarating and repelling, beautiful and disgusting about mixed martial arts. Davis hadn't thrown a single kick in the fight. In fact, he could scarcely recall having ever attempted a kick in his entire MMA career. But now, with just a few seconds to go, he took a running start and leapt at Diaz with his left foot in the air. Diaz was angling low, and Davis's shin caught him flush in the head. The sound of a man getting hicked in the head isn't nearly as benign as Hollywood would have us believe. It's not a hard smack, but a squishy sound, a reminder there's a lot of liquid and pulpy gunk surrounding that hard skull. Diaz may or may not have been knocked out on impact. He certainly was unconscious when the back of his head collided violently with the canvas. From my seat behind the ring, I could see that his eyes had drifted to the back of his head. Tastelessly, Metallica's Enter Sandman boomed on the PA system.
I'm speaking with L. John Wertheim, the author of Blood in the Cage, and you're listening to Only a Game. If what you've described there constitutes the appeal of the sport, do you feel any ambivalence in promoting it as vigorously as you do in Blood in the Cage?
Well, I don't see myself as promoting it so much as trying to explain just what this exploding culture is all about. But, you know, I mean, first of all, that was an exceptional, horrifying, I mean, again, just brutal, it made me queasy,
but
horrifying
beautiful
moment.
Beautiful, too, you say, in the passage, beautiful as well.
Well, there was a real sort of, if it was this guy's intent to deliver a perfect karate kick in sort of competitive martial arts kind of way, he did it. I was just telling someone else, well, I watched the football game the other night, and there was a player who was knocked silly late in the game, and he lay there on the ground, and all the players knelt and were praying that he wasn't unconscious, and they wheeled the ambulance out, and it was a similar kind of it was a similar kind of event to the one I had just described, and no one seemed to think much of it, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief when we learned that this player wasn't in fact paralyzed, but it wouldn't have surprised anyone if it hadn't been that way. It certainly happened before even the season in the NFL, and that incident that I watched on TV was scarier. And I think had more long-term sort of risks than anything I'd witnessed in mixed martial arts. I mean, I hate to sort of be cast as an advocate or a proponent so much as I just tried to describe this. But as far as, it's unquestionably violent. But people ask me if this should be illegal or if this should be sanctioned. And I have a hard time sort of drumming up much outrage for that.
You write of, quote, the righteousness of ultimate fighting. What did you mean by that phrase?
Well, I think there's a real sort of lack of ambiguity to it. There's no spin. There's no gloss. It is what it is, and there's a real purity to it. Part of that purity is the violence, but there also, I think there's something to be said for a sport where it's very simple. It's a winner and a loser, and they're going to go in there, and they're not worried about referees' calls and home court advantages, and the quarterback didn't throw him the ball, and the judges didn't like the performance. I mean, there's a real sort of distillation of sport that goes on there.
L. John Wertheim is the author of Blood in the Cage, Mixed Martial Arts, Pat Miletich, and the Furious Rise of the UFC. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and L. John Wertheim spoke to me from NPR in New York. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Some fans left Monday night's hockey game between the Blackhawks and the Minnesota Wild with Blackhawks pennants. Some had Blackhawks jerseys, and some had team caps. And one had $1 million. That lucky fan, who was seated in Section 326, was the beneficiary of a state lottery promotion that drops $1 million on somebody in the building if the Blackhawks score at precisely the 10-minute mark of the second period of any home game. Martin the Hands Havlat provided the goal, the only one the Hawks managed in a 4-1 loss, and after the game he accepted the thanks of the lucky fan and shuffled uncomfortably on his skates awaiting his tip. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, winning isn't everything except if you never lose. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at KUHF 88.7 FM and Houston Public Radio, to whom I will send this flashback. Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers. What are they doing in Tennessee anyway?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to acquiring a station for which there is no possible song.
Oh, that's not possible, believe me. Even if we went to a town called Rosemary, I would sing the Edison Lighthouse tune, and you know
I'd
I would.
I'd be terrified that might happen
okay,
someday.
Let's
when
move
we
on.
Last spoke, in any case, we did not know which two teams would be playing in the Super Bowl. Now we do. But since the National Football League is taking a week off, how about if we don't talk about the game until next Saturday? What do you think?
Works for me, pal. How about next year's game?
We have to talk actually a little bit about last week's game, because last weekend the Philadelphia Eagles, quarterbacked by Donovan McNabb, lost the NFC Championship game to the Arizona Cardinals, Given the way Mr. McNabb and his home in Arizona were treated by a couple of Cardinals fans, maybe we should congratulate him for performing as well as he did.
First of all, I didn't know that Donovan McNabb lived in Arizona. What a bummer for him. They left a cardboard box in the driveway that said, "Go Cards." Then he went out one side and looked at his lawn, and they used diesel fuel to burn Cardinals slogans into his lawn, which will cost him $2,000 to fix. And it turns out there's a couple of local idiots who admitted to the pranks, and I think that they should probably be put in the National Registry of Idiots for it.
I think so, too, especially since on that cardboard box you mentioned was their return address.
So, yes, they should be in the National Registry of Idiots for what they did and for getting caught.
Exactly. In Miami, will Bill Parcells, the man in charge of football operations for the Miami Dolphins, be singing "Here Comes the New Boss, Same as the Old Boss"?
Well, I'm not going to be singing it, that's for sure. You'll not get another song out of me today, Littlefield.
It's
I know
the
you're
Who. You Jedi, love the Who.
The Jedi mind tricks. It looks like he may stay. You know, there was talk that when Wayne Huizenga sold the team, that Parcells would leave too. It looks like majority Stephen Ross has, you know, put the requisite amount of ashes on his forehead, and Bill Parcells will be staying for a while.
How will fans of American Idol feel about the football version of the program, which will be hosted by former Dallas Cowboy Michael Irvin?
Well, I would point out, number one, that this is the same company that's behind The Biggest Loser, so you can make whatever redundancy jokes you want. You know, I don't know how the NFL is going to feel about this. I mean, there was a long while where the NFL did almost anything to maintain its dignity. This is certainly not part of that.
The idea is the winner of this competition gets to be a Cowboy for a day or actually try out or what?
The Cowboys say that one of the 80 roster spots is going to go to the show's winner. How'd you like to be the actual football player who gets cut from your chance to be on the practice squad because some television geek gets the job?
The New York Jets announced this week the hiring of their new head coach, Rex Ryan. Rex Ryan sounds more like a quarterback or a Broadway star than a coach to me. Maybe the winner in a dog show.
Somebody who went to grammar school with Johnny Quest. Yeah, he's another defensive coordinator, which is what the Jets seem to be aiming for. I'm not exactly sure what the purpose of firing Eric Mangini in order to hire Rex Ryan is. You know, what you've done basically is you've taken the guy who was the coordinator for the best defense in the league and hired him, and then 4 years later fired him in favor of hiring the guy who was the coordinator for the best defense in the league this year. So I suspect that in a couple of years they'll be looking around for the defensive coordinator of the Green Bay Packers or someone.
Have any of the eliminations or advancements at the Australian Open caught your eye particularly?
The only real surprise was Venus Williams going out as early as she did, especially having a match point and losing her match and being eliminated. Otherwise, you know, the first major of the year and the chalk is holding, including the predicted political fisticuffs in the stands, apparently.
Well, precisely. I'm courtesy of Bud Collins. My image of the Australian Open is happy Aussies toting coolers and having fun in the sun, but we got Serbs and Bosnians rattling each other's cages over there.
Yeah, apparently the supporters are engaging in hooliganism on the tournament grounds. A Serbian player, Novak Djokovic, beat in a really terrific match, 7-6 and 7-4 in the tiebreaker, Amir Delic, the Bosnian-born American. Out on the grounds, people got ugly, and both players have basically told their respective supporters to cool it.
Charlie, how happy do you suppose citizens of the UK were to learn that a quarter of the £2 billion London 2012 Olympics contingency fund would be depleted by 2009?
The Olympics in major financial trouble? Unpossible! Why do people keep falling for this, and why doesn't the International Olympic Committee just suck it up and go to Geneva or someplace and build a permanent site? There's nothing to recommend this bidding on the Olympics things anymore. It's corrupt. It bankrupts the municipalities. It makes local politicians at best crazy and worse crooked. It's a terrible thing time and time and time again.
A new book proposal by Jay Maguire, brother of former slugger Mark Maguire, alleges that brother Mark indulged in human growth hormone and steroids during his playing career. If you write a tell-all book and all has already been told, is it still a tell-all book?
Well, yeah, I guess it is. Apparently, a number of publishers have passed on this project already. But Mark Maguire, here's some advice. It's one thing to go in front of Congress and Stonewall. When your brother starts selling you out on a book proposal, it's time to come clean. If you're ever going to come clean, do it now.
The Cubs have found a new owner, and it will not be the Dallas Mavericks maverick Mark Cuban.
God, thank God.
The Ricketts family will pay $900 million for the Cubs, Wrigley Field, and 25% ownership stake in a regional sports network. Good deal?
As far as I can tell, yeah. I mean, the Cubs are a solid franchise. The regional sports network is a good pickup. Now we'll see if these guys are willing to spend the money to try to get the Cubs to win, because we know they never will.
Most baseball teams building a new stadium raise prices, both because they have to pay for the building and because they figure people will buy tickets no matter what they cost for the novelty of going to that new park. So how do you like the strategy employed this week by the Washington Nationals?
Terrific. Washington, after all the aggravation and all the begging and all the pleading and all the upscale panhandling, is discovering that, yes, it has another baseball team to ignore. This will be the third one. Not enough people went last year, so ticket prices were going down. Amazing. I'll tell you what really struck me about the Nationals this week, though, is, you know, we've all watched presidents be inaugurated and that panoramic shot up towards the Capitol Dome. Seeing the baseball stadium in the background was really jarring because it wasn't there the last time.
And finally, Charlie,
I love this story for so many reasons.
We know why people are encouraged to keep their dogs away from fields where games will be played. But wouldn't you have thought that somebody who keeps a parrot might have been safe bringing her pet to a soccer game?
All right, first of all, I love this story because it gives me a chance to say Hertford Heath and Hatfield Town, where hurricanes hardly happen. And it also gets me to tell you that the parrot's name is Me Too, capital M-E dash capital T-U. But I really love this story because it allows me to tell you that the referee had to send off the parrot because it kept imitating his whistle and calling the players pretty boy. And people wonder why this isn't a major sport in this country.
It will be now. Come on. Charlie Fierce.
Why would you bring a bird in a cage to the game?
He's my friend.
And apparently the referee first went over to the woman and said, stop saying this. And she said, it's not me, it's my parrot. Yeah. Sure, lady, we believe that.
Monty Python, are you listening? Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
That's a lovely fresh cuttlefish for you.
One of the prime gathering spots in the Ferris Athletic Center at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, is a pyramid covered in brown carpet topped by an electronic scoreboard that doesn't work. From any of the pyramid's levels, on any of its three sides, a seated spectator can see at least a few of the courts where the Trinity men's squash team wins. The spectators have learned to expect the winning. In fact, the Trinity men's team wins so often that their coach, Paul Asiante, long ago began thinking about headier matters than mere results.
If you come with a goal in mind, just that goal, that actually holds you back. We try to play on a much more esoteric plane, which is we try to live with the awesome power of now. And we try to encourage these kids to come every day and to give 110%. And live that match, that practice, that classroom experience as if it were the last one of their lives. If you can get 22 kids doing that every time you come together, you create a maelstrom of energy that is almost, you know, you almost can't beat that.
Well, yeah, except for the almost. Because, in fact, you can't beat that, and neither can anybody else. The Trinity men's squash team has won 10 consecutive intercollegiate championships. Teams coming to Hartford to play them don't think of winning matches or even games. They aspire to capture the odd point.
Our practice matches are very often much more difficult and more challenging than our matches against other schools.
Part of the reason for Trinity's success, according to Coach Asiante, is diversity.
First of all, we have kids coming from 11 different countries, and each one of them came here thinking they were the center of their respective club, state, city, nation. You know, Basa Chowdhury was the number one junior in the world. So when they come here, they're individuals, and they're very prideful of their individual accomplishment. And we just completely break them down. We take them through a plebe experience, if you will.
Plebe as in West Point.
As in West Point, which is where I spent 11 years. And we teach them that we don't really care about your individual accomplishments, and we're all about team. It's just about that experiential moment where we all are in the fire and we're just loving it and just fighting for the ultimate performance.
The team-oriented approach may seem an odd fit in a sport where there's no such thing as an assist, but according to Roosh Vora, a senior who came to Trinity from Mumbai, India, and who's presently ranked 28th in the country among college players, it works.
We have a bunch of different countries, and we have people, you know, from all over the Northeast in America as well. And, you know, it's like a small UN conference, you know. There's South America, Brazil, you know, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Pakistan, India. There's, you know, can't even name all the countries. The team hangs around with each other a lot. You know, there's never a fight on the team. It's the kind of camaraderie that is on the team is just unbelievable. I haven't seen this in my 12 years of squash.
Roosh Vora first heard about Trinity shortly after he began playing squash. He was 7. His brother preceded Roosh to Hartford and captained the Trinity team. On the international circuit, everybody who thinks he might like to combine squash with going to college in the U.S. hears about the nation's most successful program, and that's not the only way Paul Asiante finds each new generation of excellent players.
For 9 years, I was the USA national coach. I would take the men's team around the world to play. World championships in Cairo or Belo Horizonte, Brazil. So I developed relationships with the national coaches from all the other countries. So I would get a phone call from my friend who's the national coach in England, and he'd say, I've got a really bright guy here who's a very good squash player, and he seems inclined to go to university. Would you have any interest in recruiting him?
Sure, Coach Asiante might say, but tell him not to take anything for granted. He'll probably start out behind our guys from India and from Pakistan and our guy from Sweden, too, and maybe even the odd prep schooler from the U.S.
Rushad Fuora, Charlie Passion, and Gustav Dieter are the captains, and our assistant coach is James Montano.
On Wednesday night, Trinity hosted Yale, the number 3 men's team in the country. Roosh Vora, playing at number 9 that night, found himself matched with a freshman named C.J. Plimpton in what would turn out to be the evening's closest match.
Come on, Roosh! Come on, Roosh!
Though he fell behind in 2 of the games of the best 3-out-of-5 match, Roosh prevailed, enabling Trinity to win the team competition 9-0. Previously this season, Trinity, which has not lost a match since 1997, beat Tufts, Amherst, Williams, Brown, and Dartmouth by the same lopsided score. After the 4th and deciding game on Wednesday night, Roosh discussed the advantage he'd gained by maintaining his focus when his opponent allowed himself to be distracted.
I think, you know, my head was in there all the time and his wasn't. You know, there were points at the crucial time he lost his head and, you know, that's... It just comes with experience, so he's a freshman.
The manifestation of Plimpton's loss of concentration came in his appeals to the referee. During a game, a player who feels his opponent has impeded him as he's gone after the ball can ask the official, in this case one of the other players, for a replay of the point. Sometimes the official agrees with the appealing player, sometimes not. Sometimes the player whose appeals are denied lose their focus. Sometimes they toss their rackets, kick at the wall, even open the door of the court to explain to the official just how blind he has been. But according to Roosh, Trinity players do none of the above.
Our coach doesn't let us do that at all, and that helps.
Doesn't let you display that
unhappy. We're not allowed to look out of the court and open the door and argue. You go home that day if you do that. So basically... You know, that's a big difference because you can keep your head cool. And if you saw every time he argued, he hit the next 2 or 3 balls, he made unforced errors.
The unforced errors and the edge that experience provided enabled Roosh Vora to win his match 3-1. Each of his 8 teammates won 3-0. In 6 of the 27 games, the Yale players got no points at all, and Yale had been 8-0 before coming to Hartford. This suggests that when Trinity hosts the team from the University of Pennsylvania this afternoon, and when Trinity faces Bates, Franklin and Marshall, Harvard, Hobart, and Cornell over the next few weeks, the score will be 9-0 each time. And then on February 14th, Trinity will travel to Princeton, New Jersey, at which point, at least according to Coach Asiante, things could get interesting.
When you look at the top 25 ranked players in intercollegiate squash, 17 of them are at Trinity and Princeton. That's a ridiculous number.
No more ridiculous, perhaps, than 10 national championships in a row from a team that looks as if it might be a lock for number 11, although Paul Asiante says he doesn't assume the streak will go on forever.
It has to shift, and the streak will end. And I relish that day because coaches do a lot more teaching when they lose than when they win. I have two goals. The first goal is when we lose, I want it to be because a team came up to the bar. We wanted to establish that this is how good the game could be, and I'd like to think that somebody rises above that. And then my second goal is when we get knocked off, I'd love to go back and wrest the title back the next year.
At present, since that would require Trinity to lose, those goals don't appear to be within reach. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Brian Fadham. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Trinity College Squash photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Trinity squash player Roosh Vora, who anticipates getting a job on Wall Street after graduation.
I know there's nothing, but I'm still going to get something.
And that's the kind of attitude that's going to bring us all back, don't you think? I feel a little feel. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.